This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Mia Alvar about her new book, a collection of short stories called In the Country. Hi, Mia. How are you?
Hi, David. I'm good. How are you?
Well, thank you for doing this.
Of course.
It's now August. This book came out, I think, in June.
That's right.
So have you been doing a lot of promotional work and talking to people and doing some events?
I have. Lots of conversations with different people and readings and other panel-type things here in the city and a few outside. So
you know, writers have this sort of duality of the interior world and then the public world.
Right.
And writing is, you know, by definition, it's communicating to others. But in order to write, there's a kind of, you know, interior space that you have to inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the book comes out, if you have a book come out, you have to put that aside and join this public sphere,
right.
You know, where other people are now engaging with this work that was yours.
Right.
And now it belongs to other people too. And I've always been struck by the difficulty that creates for
mm-hmm.
writers, you know, that it's not that you might not want to do these public things, but just that the difference between those two ways of being is so profound. And since this is your first book, it's the first time it's happening to you.
Right.
And I believe that every writer has to figure out how to balance that interior private world with the public world. But have you found that to be an issue at all, or is this something you think about or not?
Oh, I think about it all the time. I am like most writers in that, you know, I sort of feel very natural turning inward and being alone in a room in front of a notebook or computer. So there are I feel that duality very intensely. And I think the strangest part about it for me is that my attraction to books and stories and fiction in general is both as a reader and a writer, you know, it's an opportunity to kind of go deep and explore and be open to complications and digressions and all of those things. Whereas, you know, a radio interview, for instance, maybe not this one, but, you know, panels or interviews and kind of public discussions of a book that's just come out is in some ways the opposite of that. It's about kind of boiling things down to, you know, an elevator pitch or a little chestnut that's nice and succinct and
right,
quotable.
Well, because it's a different experience. You're having to summarize, communicate something about
right.
another object, a work of art that was complex and took a long time to create and has this world of its own.
Right.
And it's really difficult, I think, for both for you and for readers. You know, if you sort of imagine readers are out there wandering around, you know, wondering what will they read next.
Right.
And, so that's sort of that kind of commercial environment creates this dichotomy, you know,
mm-hmm.
if you will, because, you know, the writing is not necessarily a commercial experience in and of itself.
Yeah.
You know, it's doing something.
And, right.
And so that, you know, there is that contradiction. It's really an interesting element.
Yeah. I mean, the nice part about it is the ability to connect with readers and to hear from readers and kind of hear people talk about ways in which the stories either resonated for them or kind of came alive for, you know, people outside of my own brain and immediate family. So in that way, it feels like the whole point of having written a book.
The reward, in a sense, for, you know, taking the private world into the public
right.
is that you get that kind of engagement with
mm-hmm.
people. So have you had a lot of people respond to you that you have found interesting in different ways.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I've heard from perfect strangers on the internet. I've heard from people I maybe have crossed paths with in my life, but, you know, don't have particularly deep friendships or long-term relationships with, who connected with the stories in some way. And that's been really just gratifying and nice to hear.
So, you know, just for people who are not familiar with the book at all,
mm-hmm.
or with you as a writer, you were born in the Philippines.
Right.
And you left, your parents obviously took you out of the Philippines when you were young, and then you lived in Bahrain?
Bahrain in the Middle East, yep.
And how old were you when you lived there?
It was ages 6 to 10, so 4 years. And then after that, we moved to New York, where my mother started a grad school program, and we more or less settled there, here in Manhattan. So,
and has writing been something that you did from an early age, or is it something that you became later? I mean, everybody has a different story, but
yeah, it always sort of went hand in hand with reading for me. I think around the time I was learning how to read, I had that impulse to kind of imitate, you know, the poems and the books that I was reading. I think that was partly a product of, you know, a pre-internet childhood. It was a form of entertainment and a way to kind of get more out of a book once you had finished reading it. So I was always kind of trying to write my own version of whatever I was reading. And, you know, throughout high school and most of college, I thought I wanted to be a poet, but became serious about writing fiction maybe towards the end of college.
So were there writers in particular that, I don't want to not necessarily say inspire, but mm-hmm. writers who, when you said you kind of were responding to by wanting to write after reading them, and I understand, I feel that impulse myself sometimes, you know, that the writing can be a form of conversation, you know,
mm-hmm.
that the when you read something, you want to engage with it in
right.
some way. And one way of engaging is to write your own thing that's not, I don't mean fan fiction, you know,
mm-hmm.
not of the world that the book or the story that you're reading takes place in, but your own kind of creative response.
Mm-hmm.
So are there particular books or particular writers that inspired you in that way, especially when you were in high school and college?
Yeah, well, towards the end of college, there were these short story collections that were coming out. I think this was like the mid to late 90s. They really opened things up for me. I traveled to the Philippines for the first time after many years away in my junior year of college, and had a notebook with me and was taking down things that struck me, which were many because I had been away so long. And when I came back, I was reading Junot Diaz's first collection. I was reading Jhumpa Lahiri's first collection, Samantha Chang, Nathan Englander, and they're all very different books, obviously, but they all kind of did a similar thing as far as entering a community through many different perspectives.
And your collection of stories, I noticed, I felt strongly that was one of the things that you did,
mm-hmm.
that the stories are about different kinds of people, different ages, different places in society, but also you played with point of view. So right. Some of the stories are first person. Some are kind of like a we first person, this group first person.
Right.
And then others are second, you know, second person kind of, or third person really, storytelling. So
right.
You were, you know, and it could be, you know, that gave you a chance to explore different sides to the story, you know, different ways of looking at a story or a place or a thing.
Yeah, and that was really the approach that I was committed to and inspired by. I didn't want to write a kind of sweeping epic novel where one character or one family, you know, experiences everything from, you know, the declaration of martial law in the Philippines in the 70s to, you know, 9/11 many years later. So so I decided to talk about each of these characters individually instead. And it's funny because I went to grad school. I did an MFA program. And the feedback I always got was to develop each story into a novel because they were very long. it seemed to many readers that, you know, these pieces wanted to be novels. But there was no one idea that jumped out at me that I wanted to abandon all the others.
I wanted to it's funny you brought that up because I was really interested in, you know, I think that this pressure to write novels is kind of concerning, I think, you know, that it's, you know, it seems exterior. It's not necessarily the story needs to be a novel. It's more that our expectations of a story in some way, you know, it wouldn't be commercial or it wouldn't be a real book if it wasn't a novel. And I really reject that notion. You know, I think that I think terming stories short stories, you know, it's kind of another form of categorization that is really, you know, the word short story, it's almost diminutive of the idea. What's wrong with a perfectly told story, even if it happens to be 10 pages?
Right.
You know, and I think, I know I'm not alone. I'm not the first person who brought this up, but, you know, there was this great period of, short story writing between the 20s and early 50s, which I kind of think, ironically, was commercially driven. There were magazines.
Right.
You know, that, so if you were a writer, you could write short stories and actually make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And that went away.
Right.
And then, so people kind of, writers necessarily stopped writing short stories because it wasn't commercial, and you know, a lot of writers want to make a living.
Right.
But I'm still struck by the notion that a story perfectly told is what it is, you know, and who cares how long it is? And I thought, you know, a lot of the stories that you told, maybe they could be expanded into novels. You know, anything could be ultimately, but it seemed like a lot of those stories were just right, you know, what they were.
Mm.
And so anyway, I'm glad you brought it up because it struck me that you are writing really great short stories.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you think they're the right length. I mean, readers and editors were definitely crucial to me in the process because I have a sort of more is more aesthetic when it comes to prose, and all of these stories could have been three times as long as they were. And I really relied on people to tell me when the backstory of a particular minor character was not necessary to the story. But yeah, I mean, I can definitely understand from some readers' perspectives who shy away from short stories, the desire to be sort of swept up in a world and kind of captivated and to spend time, a long time, kind of lost in that world. And I understand why it's jarring for some people to have that end sooner than they would like and have to recommit, you know, eight more times to another world.
But on the other hand, there are two things I would observe. One is the pause that a shorter story enables, you know, the reflection and the impact and thinking about what you've just experienced can be greater because you're not engaged in this lengthy process. And, you know, I read longer novels and I sometimes forget. I'll forget the beginning. You know, I have to go back and remind myself who these characters are,
right?
Even if it's engaging. And I think the other part of that is that the big story can tell certain, you know, it's really good for certain things, but the kind of miniaturist has other benefits. You know, it enables a different kind of perspective. It's like the difference between a really condensed poem and maybe, you know, Walt Whitman, who tells you everything.
Right.
You know, there's a role for both, I think. And it's just, I feel like people may be giving themselves short shrift by not letting themselves experience shorter fiction.
I agree. I mean, as a genre, it's so diverse. And there are lots of different experiences you can have reading different short story writers. You know, not every short story is this kind of spare, beautifully compressed, you know, piece of flash fiction, although those are some of my favorite stories to read. You know, you also have people like Alice Munro who, you know, just kind of explode time and you know, contain whole lifetimes and worlds within one.
Right. Well, and the other thing is that your collection has a certain of, you know, there's a continuity about it in a couple of respects. One is that all of the characters are Filipino and connected to the Philippines in some way, and you're exploring different elements of a diasporatic life over a certain period of time. So there is some continuity. You know, it's like a collection of news stories written by the same person over the course of 20 years. They're going to have a connection.
Right.
And I think all these stories are.
Right. Yeah, some of the same fictionalized real-life political figures, I guess, are in there. And those are the only recurring characters, if you can call them that, in the collection. But that certainly was my hope, was a certain kind of continuity, even though you can't call it a linked collection in that, you know, there are no linked plots or you know, recurring characters or anything like that. But I liked the way one reader put it to me, which is that she felt like all of these people could have crossed paths, you know, socially or at a party or at some point in their lives outside of the stories, that maybe they would have known each other or had relatives who knew each other. And, you know, that was certainly my experience growing up as well, that particularly when in an immigrant family, whenever my parents or aunts and uncles would meet someone who was also Filipino or and an immigrant to the community they were in, there was always this kind of grasping for connection and did we, you know,
you mean to see if they
the same
know
school,
the same people?
Yeah, exactly.
So kind of a desire to feel connected.
Yes.
Because you are disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be particularly true in places like Bahrain where, you know, you've set stories there where it seems really complicated for people who went there to work?
Oh, definitely.
You know, and feel like they're working away from home and going, and I love that the guys who are working in Bahrain each goes home periodically bringing things
right.
both directions for the others and for the others' families, so that they become kind of figures in the families of the other workers,
right.
the other guys.
Right.
And it just, it felt, that was so evocative and kind of sad. You know, you feel these
yeah.
people have lives that are hard and emotionally draining, because if you're thousands of miles away from home and, you know, you have to connect to people in these weird ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was really interested in that kind of suspended migrant status of a lot of the Filipino workers in the Middle East. You know, when my family moved here to New York, it was almost understood that we would, that we were immigrating, and that we,
that you would stay here,
right?
That this was not a way station,
and, right?
Yeah,
and the end goal was, you know, naturalizing right. And becoming citizens. And I think that concept is less, much less of a thing in among Filipinos in Bahrain or Saudi Arabia. You know, even if they live there for years or decades at a time, it's always with the goal of retiring in the Philippines and returning right. home, even if home has not
really,
been
well,
home.
Because they're called guest workers.
Right.
And they are always perpetually foreigners.
Living contract to contract, basically.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the things I tried to talk about in the book was how a lot of the social distinctions, class distinctions that would maybe be more pronounced in Manila sort of start to collapse in among Filipinos in Bahrain who are there. They're sort of equally homesick and nostalgic for the same flavors and memories. And so there's this kind of community that forms. But I also wanted to know how robust that was. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of the story Shadow Families, where I wanted to know the limits of that. If they were there.
So that sort of raises another question for me, and that is, you know, a lot of the things you write about are, you know, I imagine required some learning on your part, because, you know, you lived in Bahrain, but you were 6 or 8 or 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the experiences you write about are adult experiences. In fact, some of them are really adult experiences.
Right.
But I also thought about, you know, the fact that you, because you didn't grow up in the Philippines beyond your earliest years, a lot of the things that you just alluded to, the kind of social relationships and dialects and linguistic issues of a country that you
right.
didn't really directly experience are in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So you, did you, was that a, I mean, what was your process for understanding the relationships of people in the Philippines when you actually didn't spend that much time there?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was really interesting for me, because I, for a long time, I thought that, you know, I would sort of exploit, for lack of a better word, these, you know, family anecdotes and memories, do a little bit of research, and then kind of get lost with my own imagination and then sort of fact check my imagination at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But that fact checking process never really went the way I expected, because people's memories are not that reliable, no matter how old you are, no
that
matter how
true.
Much time you spent in the Philippines or in the Middle East. So I would always go to my parents or my aunts and uncles and say, you know, is it does it seem plausible that that this person would socialize with this other person, or would it ever happen that this person would be or that people would think, you know, she had, this character Baby had married a Bahraini, for instance. And they would always sort of shrug and say, I guess so.
It was like anything can happen.
Right. It was never that definitive kind of answer that I was looking for. And so I really had to trust that the work I had done, you know, combining a little bit of research and memory, but also just spending enough time with these characters and working hard on sort of building a world that worked on the page was enough, and that that if all of these elements kind of worked together somehow, that that they would be convincing for a reader and real enough in the world that I had created, even if they wouldn't stand up to a real life fact check, or even if nobody I knew had encountered exactly that situation.
So you have, and clearly you have not had someone, let's say, who spent more time in the Philippines say to you, that would never happen. And then you can say, well, but it's fiction.
I haven't yet, but I am very curious about going to the Philippines in November, which I'm going to do for a literary festival there, to see, I've heard positive things from readers there, but I haven't yet spoken to a full Filipino audience. So I'm curious.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, there are some details, like I think in one of the stories, you know, you have this guy come home from America to his, he's a pharmacist, and he has to come and take care of his mother, and she runs a little store, which I thought you described in this really, you know, is very evocative, and then you wonder if someone who actually, you know, knows one of those stores says, no, that detail is wrong. that'll be interesting.
Yeah, well, that's one detail I feel a little bit confident about, because the Sari Sari store, the kind of general store, really did get added to my childhood home in the Philippines, and I really did spend some time when I went to visit,
right.
But but even then, I think it's very boring for a writer, and I think consequently also for a reader, when you try to transcribe things exactly as you experience them in real life.
I think, though, you're in this unusual situation that I think, you know, might, just because you are from a place and writing about it, and again, it is fiction, and you have lots of leeway there. But you can sort of understand that the person who didn't leave the Philippines might feel something different.
Oh, of course,
reading your work,
yeah,
sort of an interesting idea.
Yeah, but it was really important to me at the same time to keep reminding myself that I had that space and that license, because again, I would really, the times when I was most stuck writing the book were when I was obsessing about factual accuracy, whether it was the distance between point A and point B on a map, or, you know, trying to remember things exactly as they happened, if they were taken from a personal experience. And those were the times when I had to sort of step back and say, okay, well, let's change this place name,
right,
or let's even not name this political figure that I'm clearly sort of referring to.
Right. But so reality is inspiration. It doesn't, that way you're freed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So would you mind reading a couple of pages from the book?
No, not
at
all.
That would be really nice. I think I'd like to hear it.
Sure. So I'll read from the beginning of this story called The Contravida. My mother was waiting in front of our house when I rode up in a taxi. "There you are," she said, as if we'd simply lost each other for an hour or two at a party. I only half embraced her, afraid she might break if I held too tight. She hadn't been able to collect me from the airport herself. Years ago, my father had forbidden her to drive, though I supposed he could do little to prevent it now. "Let me," she said, reaching for my suitcase. I waved her away. I would no sooner allow my mother to carry my suitcase than allow her to carry me. "Oh, Steve," she protested, "you don't know my strength." She dropped her arms, flattening the palms against her lap, a habit I remembered well. Throughout my childhood, she often looked to be drying her hands on an apron, whether or not she was wearing one. In the decade since I left, she hadn't aged exactly. To my eyes, she seemed not older, but more. More frail, more tired, softer spoken, her dark, teaspoon-shaped face cast farther down. Every feature I remembered had settled in her and been more deeply confirmed. My parents still lived in Mabini Heights, a suburb of Manila and monument to a time when they belonged to the middle class. My father had called himself an import-export businessman before sliding through the years down a spiral of unrelated jobs, each more menial than the last and harder for him to keep. And my mother had been a nurse before he banned her from working outside the house altogether. But if they'd come down in the world, so had Mabini Heights. Ever since my childhood in the 70s, when so much of that middle class fled Marcos and martial law, houses had been left unfinished or carved up for different uses. Squatters set up camp amid the scaffolding and roofless rooms. Families took in boarders or relatives. Our house had changed too. On its right, a gray, unpainted cinder block cell had been added, taking up what used to be a yard. My parents had cemented over the grass and built this sari-sari store 5 years earlier, selling snacks and other odds and ends through a sliding wicket to people on the street. The sari-sari compromised what I imagine was the dream of my parents, who grew up poor. A green buffer between the world and their world. The addition seemed to shrink the main house to a toy, its windows tiny and its clay roof something storybook elves might have built. Next to it, I felt gigantic. I hunched my shoulders as I followed my mother inside. I was convinced, walking behind her, that the dishes on the shelves were rattling. "Papa's in here," said my mother, opening the door to my old bedroom. The blast of cold came as a shock, then a relief. There was an air conditioner now, in the window under which I used to sleep as a child, and my old bed, where my father lay, was pushed into a corner. I saw from the straw mat rolled up beside him that my mother had been sleeping on the floor at night. Otherwise, the room was clean and bare and quiet as I remembered. Same white cinder block walls, same wood-tiled floors, same smell of mothballs from the same chest of drawers, if all faded a little, like an old photograph. My mother kept a tidy house, a trait we shared, and things probably lasted longer in her care. Two oxygen tanks stood beside my father's bed. He breathed through a tube. The sight of him brought me back to New York, where I lived, and to the hospital where I worked as a clinical pharmacist. My father no longer resembled me. The short boxer's physique, a bullish muscularity I'd always detested sharing with him, was gone. In fact, he no longer resembled anyone in the family. He belonged now to that transnational tribe of the sick and the dying. Without the dentures he'd worn most of his adult life, my father's mouth was a pit, a wrinkled open wound below the nose. What I could see of his eyes, under lids that were three-quarters closed, did not appear to see me back. He looked not only thin, but vacuum-dried, desiccated, less a human than the prehistoric remains of one.
Really good.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I really want to thank you for doing this. It's been really good talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks. This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors, and I've had the great pleasure of talking to Mia Alvar about In the Country, her first collection of stories. Thanks.
Thanks, David.